Gary, welcome, man. We're Thanks. So glad you're here. We're grateful that you stopped by, adjusted a little bit of your plans to see us today. Know you're a busy guy, but I was telling you right when we walked in that we could not let you get back to Utah without stopping by the farm. So just thanks for stopping by. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Well, my pleasure. I was saying, even just coming onto the campus, right? It's amazing. I just have a lot of good memories about coming out here. A lot of good recovery pieces. I mean, the early days, I remember coming out here, and a lot of folks won't remember this, but there was a piece called the Nashville Summit that was back in the days of the early days of medication-assisted therapy. And really, they, you know, one of the things that I always admired about the facility is you brought out, I guess, at least the people that, you know, that we thought were thought leaders at the time.
Yeah.
And it was really this collaboration of, and really a lot of smart people. I remember being very, almost intimidated, right, by the group of people that that Cumberland had brought out. And it was a big honor for me to be included in that group. But yeah, I just always, you know, you come out. I remember coming out for a couple concerts, and it was, I just really liked what you always did.
Yeah. Right? So. Shout out to Walt Quinn. He was actually on the podcast a couple weeks ago and talking all about the history and telling some interesting stories of behind the scenes of how all that came to be. So before we get any further, Gary, would you mind introducing yourself?
So my name's Gary Fisher, and I am the director emeritus from the Cirque Lodge in Sundance, Utah. So I worked for the lodge for 23 years, and before that I had another 10 years working in behavioral health before I ever went to work at the lodge. But it was an interesting time, right? And I don't know how far afield you want me to go with it, but it was the late 1990s, and managed care had kind of come in and kind of torn the heart out of treatment, right?
Right.
And it wasn't, and I don't put that on the insurance companies. I think, you know, the treatment centers had not been very good stewards. And stewards of the clients or the funds they were being paid. And so as a result, it was the advent of managed care. That was a term that a lot of folks back at that time hadn't heard, right? But basically, and their job was to manage the care, make sure that, you know, that they had some oversight. But ultimately, what ended up happening, at least from our point of view, was that a lot of folks who really needed care weren't getting it. And, you know, you would have somebody doing some case management for a client in Nashville, Tennessee, and the case manager was over in, you know, Irvine, California. Mm. And, you know, it was kind of in terms like, well, they don't meet medical necessity, or, you know, they don't meet clinical necessity for this level of care, terms that, you know, today are fairly common. But back in those days were terms that, you know, we had never heard. All we knew is that we were discharging people after very short lengths of stay. So people would be leaving after 6 or 7 days of care, and then ultimately coming back and coming back into treatment many, many times. And so there was this,
right,
really this perception that treatment didn't work, right? And you know, I would always say that treatment, the way they were designing it, wasn't working. But at any rate, so it's late 1999, and the gentleman by the name of Richard Losey has this idea to do treatment, but not take any third-party pay. We're going to have people pay cash. And so, in other words, you know, you come in and you come to care. And, you know, in conjunction with your therapist, decide really on what the length of stay was going to be. And so no pressure from some outside third party. And at the time, you know, today there's probably lots of cash options. But back in those days, there were very, very few. And I remember the big fear, right? The big fear was, well, my God, it's going to, narrow the funnel. And really our idea is if we're going to go out of business, let's go out of business on our terms. Mm. Let's not go out of business on the terms of a third-party payer that was either going to not pay us or slow pay us and I don't want to make this like they were villains or anything like that. It was that they just had a different opinion of what needed to happen than maybe our clinicians were having.
In a lot of ways, I think at the time, our field was, and we still struggle with this, but speaking in a language that a larger, broader science medical communities can't hear in, right? And although managed care in some ways damaged providers in terms of their ability to reflex into those standards. And also, like you said, the biggest one was probably the perception that addiction care doesn't work or that there's kind of money hungry players in the field that just want to take people's money and not help them. But in some ways, managed care might have helped the field.
Oh.
Like you said, now today, the language of medical, clinical necessity and presentation are things that are just part of the trade, part of what we do every single day, part of the language that we speak that allows us to maybe better step into those partnerships with payers that allow for people to stay engaged in treatment over longer periods of time. And it makes sense because if you understand our history, recovery, 12-step culture, so too did the field grow in parallel. It's just interesting that you had that, because I don't know if you know this, I wasn't working then. but it's very valuable that we capture and celebrate that history of understanding where we come from so we don't vilify those relationships.
Well, and I think, and I think that happens today, right?
Yeah, because how does it happen today?
I think it happens today because, you have a couple of different groups, right? We'll have the abstinence-based treatment guys, and we'll have the harm reduction guys, and somehow it gets into this that our way, you might not want my way, but there's another way. Let me get you into this other.
Right.
This other section. And that was the same thing back in the day. And the truth of the matter is the treatment field, Nick, our vernacular, has been terrible, right? We didn't talk about like disease reoccurrence. We talked about relapse, right?
Right.
And oftentimes these people were relapsing within 30, 60 days. And it really wasn't a different treatment episode, right? It was the same treatment episode. They just weren't in any other diagnosis. We would have just called it a reoccurrence.
Right.
We wouldn't have called it a relapse. And so, in many ways, I think that we shot ourselves in the foot with some of the vernacular that we stubbornly held on to for a long time. And then again, we get into that part where. You can be in my lane or you can be in that lane, but you can't be in both lanes. Mm. And the truth of the matter is that that was just false, right? Mm. For a long time, CIRC was, and still is to this day, an abstinence-based treatment organization.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that everybody succeeds with abstinence.
Absolutely.
And I'll say this, with the advent of, back when I was, I'm a guy in recovery, right? And so... But back in the day, as ruthless as we thought alcohol and drugs were, weed, cocaine, heroin, opiates in general, there was no fentanyl in the game, right? And that's such a game changer in my mind, because a lot of times these guys never get back to care, right? Mm. Or they're overdosing so quickly, and overdose means dying. And so in many ways, I think that we just have to be benevolent. Again, it's like, we might have different philosophies about how people get better, but the fact of the matter is get better. We can, let's survive here, We can thrive later, right?
Yeah.
And if you're into the thriving part out of the gate, great. You know, let's do that. But
can you speak to, because I want to learn and hear more about your experiences with Cirque start to finish, because we just have so much respect for what you and your team and the folks out there have built, and Brittany, of course, mm-hmm. nowadays. But I think it's really interesting to tell the story as two people in recovery about that. In some ways, if I might describe it as self-righteousness, about this way is the right way and this other way is the wrong way. And it's either, you know, if you want to do it the right way, you'll do it this way. And if you'd want to do it the wrong way, then you'll just have to do that somewhere else. Can you speak to why it is that that phenomenon has occurred in our field?
Well, and again, this is, you know, I think personal opinion, right?
Please.
So take it for what it's worth. But I think for a long time the thought was it would be very difficult to combine these two milieus, right? So the milieu were people were just, you know, it was abstinence based, and then all of a sudden they're looking over here at this group doing this opioid replacement therapy, and it's like, hey, I want some of that. And the truth of the matter is, I don't believe that was ever true, right? But that was, that's what we believed, right?
Fear,
at the time.
Yeah.
It was this fear that, you know, that we were going to contaminate the, you know, both groups. And, you know, it was funny because I just came back from a piece. We got the opportunity to participate over at OnSite and went through this men's retreat. And one of the things that, but the best part of some of those retreats is those conversations that you have after the sessions are over. And we were sitting and we were talking, and I think initially everybody believed that the thought would be that the folks who were attempting to do the abstinence trail would get pulled over to the folks who were doing the replacement therapies, right? But the truth of the matter is that the people, you know, the people who are doing the replacement therapy, the medication-assisted treatment, my belief is they're actually attracted to the abstinence-based guys, right? So I think if we combine these groups, that they'll actually, you know, we just give somebody a chance to get their feet on the ground. And for most of the people who've known me my whole life, that has not always been my philosophy, right? And so, but, you know, and again, it was, you know, like I said, in defense of that group, it was, you know, the drugs are more deadly, and they are, right?
Especially today.
I mean, it's, you know, it's, call it an epidemic is to undersell it. Right?
Absolutely.
And so.
It reminds me of, because I still consider myself a young man, although Steve calls me old these days. But what I'd say is, because I'm in recovery too, and I remember, Gary, when I had a year clean and how excited I was for recovery. Mm. And when I say that, an example would be like, I'd be on a Southwest flight, who knows where, maybe visiting family or something. And I would always find a way in a conversation with somebody sitting next to me to talk about my participation in 12-step culture and maybe even bust out some literature and be like, have you seen this step working guide before? You know, and somebody's just like, whoa, man, like we just went off the rails, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that what it speaks to in people in recovery, when we talk about kind of the infusion of evidence-based therapies into our field and how that challenges our preconceived notions about what's good and what's not good for patients or clients, is that a lot of us that work in this practice or this field are in recovery themselves. And it can be really challenging if you don't watch out, if you don't have guys like you who have more experience to say, you know, it doesn't have to be an and. Mm. It can be an or. And it doesn't have to challenge our own kind of ways of being with our own recovery journeys. So I think that's what the fear was, is I was at Cumberland Heights just 6 short years ago when we were in the process of really adopting MAT system-wide. And really what I mean by that is we were using naltrexone for a long time, mm-hmm. and we were using buprenorphine for a long time, Chappie Sledge, of course, for detox only. But we hadn't made that transition into using buprenorphine extended tapers throughout the course of treatment mm-hmm. and potentially post-discharge. And gosh, I remember many meetings with our staff worried that people were going to quit, worried and fearful how the community was going to react. And when we went ahead and made the decision that we were going to move forward and just do this, we made it an issue. Mm. It was a non-issue to our community. And in some ways, our community was like, I think that's a good thing. You know, you're helping people reduce the risk of overdose. And in a lot of ways these days, death, and right. giving them that chance to maybe buy into the principles of recovery. It might not look like the recovery that you and I traditionally participate in, but hey, man, if they're plugged into a community and a spiritual yeah. practice, it's going to be okay.
Because that's what recovery is, right? Recovery yeah. is that connection with others. You know, yeah. if we can just get them into community, we'll get it. You know, yeah. then they can self-select, right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's never our job to decide what recovery should look like for each other. It's like, look, this is what it looks like for me.
Yeah.
And you know something, and I'm a big proponent of it. And you know, I was a young man who, you know, I couldn't go 30 minutes without having a cocktail or smoking a joint or doing some cocaine. And so, you know, I mean, I I actually had the opportunity to be incarcerated, right? But I oftentimes said that the greatest incarceration I ever experienced was this incarceration that I was in with under the influence of drugs. And so, you know, and like you said about being on the plane, that's awesome because, man, you're like this man with a new life, right? And you want to share.
Of course.
Right? I want to share with you, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But oftentimes it's kind of like what, you know, I oftentimes used to say, you know, there's lots of roads to Rome, you know, and you know, this road, this might be the road that Circ Lodge is on, and this might be the road that Cumberland's on. And, you know, one of the things that I'll share with you is that, I think about the courage, right, that it was for some of the long-time treatment groups, really the anchor groups of recovery, you know, to start to make those changes, right? And to kind of get a different perspective and say, look, let's look at doing this different. And, you know, and that's the, you know, and there's lots of things that, you know, over a period of time, I remember, I mean, this will probably scare the hell out of your listening audience, but, you know, when I came in or when I was getting sober, they were doing aversion therapy where they'd actually make people ill, right? To, you know, and that was, if we do this long enough, these people will, you know, be repulsed by the eye. I mean, you know, and at some point somebody thought that was a good idea.
Right.
Right. That was a good, and they were well-meaning. They were, you know, they had the science of the day. Right. And so that was, and I think out of that, you know, it's, some different, and always we were trying to kind of raise the bottom. I mean, really, that's what treatment does, right? We, fortunately, I mean, I, you know, my bottom was jails, but really, my bottom was is that I didn't speak to anybody in my family, right? My bottom was is that I had a really very short-lived marriage. I mean, months and days, not, those were, and so, you know, the idea of coming into treatment is, hey, you don't have to suffer that, right? We can raise this bottom. And, you know, and again, you know, the problem or the scary part today for even a guy who's, been 37 years now in the treatment industry, and I'm retired now, but let's say it was those 35. It's much more deadly today, right? I mean, the friends that I went to college with, they weren't, nobody was dying the next day, right? That's not what you walked into. And so, I think it's incumbent upon the thought leaders in the industry today to, you know, to start to change the vernacular and start to be more inclusive, you know, with the different treatment entities.
I really find it very helpful to, whether it's you or, you know, Steve or Jay, he'll kill me for lumping him in that, but, you know, to lean on our history in a way that makes us understand. You said the science of the day.
Yeah.
It's important because oftentimes, you know, we're all the protagonist in our own story, right? Mm. And we always think that we're on the cutting edge.
Right.
You know, whatever day is the present.
Right.
And like you said, aversion therapies, that day, that was a cutting edge.
Yeah.
You know, the integration of SSRIs at that time and the similar journey that it had to MAT into our field, that was the science of the day. MAT 20 years ago, 10 years ago for some providers, 6 years ago, the science of the day and what is it today? And we need to always, what I like to say about Cumberland, and I mean this with all respect, and providers like us, like CERC or, you know, maybe Fellowship Hall in North Carolina, whoever it is we try our best to be meat and three. You know, everybody loves meat and three, and you know what you can expect, right? And there's something to be said about a provider that can be around for a long time and remain consistent. Mm. You know, there's maybe even something spiritual in some ways about it of not having to. We want to invest. We want to do our due diligence with therapies. We want to try new things out to raise folks' bottom. That's the name of the game, right? That's our mission. But we want to be careful and we want to be cautious that everything that we do is in lockstep with making sure that we're supporting folks that are being affected by addiction. And so today, like you're mentioning with fentanyl, just to be clear, right? Just to be very clear, like, yeah, it's a good idea for us to start considering and implementing harm reduction modalities that help give people a chance to stay alive long enough to experience some version of recovery. I've told a story before, I won't tell it again, but Michael Botticelli, a former drug czar, he did a talk when I was in graduate school, and this is another example that you'll love, but basically at the end of his presentation, I was like first year graduate student, and I was the first person to ask a question. And I kind of got into his face, I mean like from the crowd, and was like, you know, how do you think this is going to impact, you know, the recovery culture of these folks? And, you know, he very politely and very accessibly, you know, responded. And then afterwards came and found me.
Oh, wow.
Which is, says something about him.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up having a really nice conversation. He killed me with kindness is what he did, you know, and just said, he's like, you know, Nick, we're just, the policy of the government right now is, and the Office of National Drug Control Policy is just try to keep people alive long enough to experience what you've experienced. And I was like, dang.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things about it is like, you know, whether it's Cumberland or whether, certainly at CERC, you know, I mean, the social economic demographic that we get to work with that I got to work with back at that time, I mean, there were many, many resources, right?
Yep.
I mean, and I really oftentimes think that the real saints of the industry were the guys who were working with the indigent and low-income populations.
No resources.
No resources. And so, hey, man, we just need to get somebody to tomorrow.
Yep.
And, you know, and the thing about it is that and maybe because of that, right, we've been slow to assimilate some of these new ideas. And I do think there is some prudence. And, you know, I mean, there's been so many different treatment ideas, right, medication ideas about, you know, the latest silver bullet, right, that was going to cure this or cure that. And we're not that. You know, they weren't. You know, they weren't a panacea. In fact, if anything, it kind of, in some ways, opened Pandora's box. So there is a part about being prudent about how we, you know, we make these steps. But I do think that, you know, as you go along, I remember I'll share this story with you. I was sitting with a gentleman who was the medical director of a fairly prominent treatment group here in the country, And they too were moving to, you know, some medication-assisted therapies, opioid replacement therapy, whatever anybody wants to call it. And I remember having a conversation and again, kind of, you know, like Michael Botticelli, just kind of killing me with kindness. And I said, you know, I said, it's not so much that, that when you guys do this, that you won't do it well, because I believe that, right? But then it'll be, it's just going to open, you know, kind of for every facility who might not do it that well in the country to kind of adopt this, you know, this policy. And I'll never forget, he said to me, he said, you know, Gary, he said, unlike you, he said, you know, I'll be sitting across from a young man and I realize that I can make sure he doesn't die tomorrow by just writing this prescription. And he said, you know, he said, and I get it. You don't have that capability. But he said, I don't know that I could live with myself by not taking this opportunity to make sure that this young man or this young woman isn't with us tomorrow. Mm. And, you know, I had such, man, at this time, I mean, it was just like, kind of something in my heart opened up, and I said, you know, I so get you, and I understand that, and I think if I was sitting in that chair, that would be the decision I was making.
Yeah.
Now, it's not that we changed our policy at that point to, you know, to go along with that, but it gave me great empathy, I guess, for, you know, for the dilemmas that we face, and I think it was enlightening for me to kind of start to understand why people were moving in that direction. And then, you know, fentanyl's just kind of, you know, made that.
Yeah. One of the last things I'll say, and then I want to ask you about CERC and your experience, is just God's got us. God's got this field. You know, I like to say this a lot, but, you know, we're all temporary proprietors. You know, so I today at Cumberland, you know, I'm not going to be here forever. You know, Jay's not going to be here forever. You know, our nurses, our admission staff, our counselors. And I think it's just our job to make sure that we do the best job we can, you know. So take me back to the beginning of your time with CERC. I want to hear all about that and what got you down that road. So I think that's really interesting.
Well, it's kind of an interesting piece. I had... I was working with a friend at that time, and we were taking nonprofits, maybe a little less sophisticated nonprofit than a place like Cumberland, but, you know, there were a lot of mom-and-pop nonprofits in the chemical dependency arena that all depended on state and county funding for, you know, to be able to provide treatment. And that worked great when the state and county coffers were full, right? But all of a sudden, the budgets, the states had a hard time, and then all of a sudden, nobody was getting treated. And so this friend and I, we had the opportunity, and we had a lot of experience in managed care contracting. I had worked for the Sisters of the Holy Cross at one point, and I had worked for Charter at one point, and so had gotten a fairly good education about doing managed care contracting. And so we were taking these nonprofits and... getting them impaneled with third-party payers. And so what that did was give them a different revenue stream. And so even, you know, it just made it more viable. And so, and it was pretty lucrative, right? I mean, we got paid pretty well to do it. And the truth of the matter is my friend got his PhD, and he had always wanted to kind of open his own shop. So he did. And at that point, I was kind of out there on my own. And about that time, I received a phone call from a friend of mine to wanting to know if I was interested in coming back and working in residential care. And the place ultimately ended up was going to be CERC Lodge. And I said, oh, I said, I'm not really interested in that. Because like as I had mentioned earlier, you know, it was kind of a tough time in treatment, right? You know, the managed care folks had come in and, I mean, it had gotten pretty skinny. You know, there was no...
It's a good word.
Yeah, skinny.
Yeah.
And so at any rate, I remember I went up to... they were having a lecture, and they had an interventionist in town by the name of Ed Storty who came in, and he was doing this lecture, and they invited me to come up and to listen to Ed. And I knew who Ed was, right? And so, and I was interested, and I was really interested in going up and seeing the facility. And to tell you how different it was, Nick, we had, back then, we talk about the science of the day, right? And the science of the day at that time, people, I mean, the treatment centers were really not very nice, right? I mean, it was either the, you know, the bottom unit in some hospital or the psych floor with the ugly green tile. And
yeah.
I mean, you felt like a criminal being in
yeah.
chemical dependency care. And I remember going up in this, it was this mountain lodge, right? And you'd heard about places like this place in Malibu or Sierra Tucson that were, you know, but I mean, I remember going up and almost literally when I tell you this, I could just almost got the goosebumps, right? And I went, wow. And Ed got up and talked about a change, right? Talk about a paradigm shift. And he was talking, and I at this point, I had been involved in a few interventions just because I had been in behavioral health, right? And he was talking about his kind of motivational style of intervention versus confrontational style. And he talked about doing these letters, but instead of letters like the, you know, you can't, if you don't stop, you can't see the kids or you can't come home or things like that. And he talked about, hey, we're gonna talk about love.
Right.
Right? We're gonna talk about, hey, you know, we want you back. We want you back in this. And he ended up telling this story. It was such a great story. That this gentleman had walked in and everybody was seated in the chairs and he knew exactly what was happening. And so he said, oh, I don't oversell. I'm ready to go. I'll go right now. And it was what Ed said then. He said, you know, he said, sit down. He said, because he said, it's not every day that people are going to tell you how much they love you when you're alive. Mm-hmm. And he called it the living eulogy. And, man, it was like, you know, hey, this was the new math, right? I had never heard this in my, you know, it was like, wow, this is like, you know, I wanted to know this guy, right?
Yeah, and of
because,
course.
You know, sometimes back in those days, I would think that the intervention was almost as traumatic and anger producing as the alcoholism and drug addiction had been, right?
Very confrontational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
So here I am, I'm in this, And this was the facility my friend had talked to me about, and we ended up having a couple of conversations. And the truth of the matter was, is they started this treatment center in Sundance, Utah, and the truth was nobody came, right? Because for therapists, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it was new to them, right? All of a sudden, I remember I had this one therapist who said, so, don't you think that's mollycoddling? I remember the word mollycoddling. I don't think I'd ever heard that, right?
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, why is it that when people go to the, you know, the hospitals of the day, to tell you how far back this was, Nick, it was, they still had wallpaper, right? People were using wallpaper and there were armoires. And I remember this nurse saying to me at one point, I said, wow, this is a nice hospital room. And she said, well, yeah, it's better for the patient.
Huh.
Never forget that. And I said, why wouldn't we do that for the chemical dependency client?
Right.
You know, why don't, let's you know, we punish ourselves enough, right? I mean, I talk about being your own worst self-critic. So they didn't need to see that sitting on the, you know, the bottom floor of the psych unit at the University of Utah Hospital, right? It was like, look, let's put these people in a, you know, let's kind of start to take this shame away. That was the that was the new science of, I mean, it sounds like, even believe
yep.
that was happening,
yep.
but that was the truth. So at any rate, I ended up coming and they were very malleable. And the owner was a gentleman who, he had resources, right? And I remember him saying, I remember saying to him, Nick, and this I think was the part that totally sold me, as I said, what's in this for you? And he said, and he laughed, kind of chuckled, and he said, well, I don't need a check, but I'd like to quit writing so many. And but what he told me that was really poignant was he said, you know, he said, I'm a good businessman, but I don't think he thought that he'd ever done anything great.
Mm.
And he really believed this was going to be great. And he said, I believe it'll be great whether you come with me or not. And that was attractive, right? We talk about attraction rather than promotion, right? And I will say this, you know, so it wasn't this part where we were worried about full-time employees or, you know, some sort of expense. You know, Franklin had this line. He said, the definition of character is the ability to carry out your decision after the emotion of the moment has passed. Mm. And I always loved that. Mm. But I oftentimes used to say, you know, it's easier to have good character when your owner has deep pockets. And so, you know, I was never put in that decision about having to keep somebody that was going to be disruptive to the milieu. I was never put in the position of having to discharge somebody because they didn't have the funds to stay in care. And that was all Richard Losey, right? I mean, he gave me that autonomy. Oftentimes say I cost that man millions of dollars, right? Yeah. But the point was is that, and when you can do what you say you're going to do for an extended period of time, that develops trust, right? And so, you know, I really think that, you know, hey, look, it's we were able to hire, you know, a talented team, but there's lots of talented teams, right? There are. I mean, there's talented teams at Cumberland, at Karen, at Hazelden, at, you know, you Fellowship Hall. But, you know, I think one of the parts is we were able to kind of keep this trust with the public. And, you know, I believe they still do, right? And mm-hmm. and I think one of the greatest pieces for me was, you know, after I left, they actually are better, right? Sometimes, you know, I'll tell you guys a story. I'm sorry, the podcast people are probably like, oh, my God.
No,
but,
no, this is great.
You know, I was a big George Washington fan, right?
Yeah.
So, and oftentimes, you know, what many people don't know is that they'll say that George Washington's greatest contribution to our country wasn't the fact that he led the Continental Army or anything like that, but that he retired. Mm. He retired. And kind of he knew when to get out of the way. But the reason that it's easy to get out of the way is if you have this group coming up behind you, right? And that was one of the things I think, you know, you mentioned Brittany Harris, right? And I mean, just an incredibly talented young woman with a ton of energy and new visions. So the fact of the matter is, you know, the gentleman who was the experiential therapist with me, maybe one of the most talented guys in the country. And, you know, as he retires, there's these, you know, this younger echelon of experiential guys right behind him. And I was down there the other day. And I mean, these people are, it's brilliant, right? Just going out to on-site, right? Seeing this vision that Miles Adcox has. I mean, it's tremendous. And his staff coming here, seeing you.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, hanging out with you guys. We got the opportunity to talk a little bit earlier about, you know, going up to a conference at Bill Wilson's house. But the thing about it was, is it really wasn't for me, you know, the material or the curriculum or anything like that. It was looking around and going, oh, we're good, right? I mean, it's in good hands, right? And the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm not being self-depreciating. You know, I was a pretty smart guy. Mm-hmm. But the group today is smarter. Mm-hmm. The group today is, I mean, they have more knowledge, as they should, right? And it's incumbent for us to put those people in charge and to get the new ideas, right? And not that we don't listen to our elders and learn from our history about why we did things and didn't do things. But, you know, like George Washington, you know, it's just, you just need to know when to get out of the way, right? Better to go a year too early than a day too late, I promise.
Well, I agree with everything you said, and there's so much wisdom in all that. But Gary, you also had a tremendous impact, and I know Brittany would say the same thing if she was here. She'd want me to say the same thing. And I love her, and I've gotten the chance to get to know her more as a person. You know, not the credentials that we all walk around with, or the but as a person, she's a wonderful person. But that speaks to you, you know, in a lot of ways, and the leadership that you had. I was going to ask you a leadership question, but I'm going to say something else that I was going to save to the end, because Who cares? When I got into recovery, my sponsor at the time, Lewis L. from Lubbock, Texas, always taught me that you did three things when you were introducing somebody or giving somebody a chip or introducing them to speak. You know, you described how they had been of service to other people. You say something about them that they wouldn't ordinarily say about themselves, and then you talk about how they touched your heart. So one thing about you, Gary, I'm just going to put you on blast. But one thing about you that I've always noticed over my short period of time, you know, in this field, in this community, is I see you being of service to everyone around you in ways that everybody I talked to, when I mentioned Gary Fisher, like when I texted Jay just to remind him this morning that Gary was going to be here, like, I don't get a lot of colorful messages from Jay, you know. I'm giving him a hard time, but he was so disappointed that he wasn't going to get to be here because he loves you, because your posture, your way of being when you're with people is that they're the most important person here. And I think that speaks to your character. Something that I think you wouldn't say about yourself is that you have this humble leadership about you that I think is special and unique. You know, a couple years ago, we were at a conference, I don't remember where, Gary, it was at NAATP, and you gave Ruth Ann Rigby an award. And one thing I learned about you is it wasn't about you, and you didn't make it about you, but you presented this award, and there wasn't a dry eye because it was so important to you that you honored her and her service. And we love her. She's amazing, right? Because but it really affected me in a way, just to see the type of leader that you were, you know, because to be honest, Gary, like, for those that are listening, you know, one of the more successful people in our field, you had a tremendous impact on hundreds, if not thousands, of people's lives in and out of the rooms. And the last thing is how you've touched my heart in particular. And it was when we were in Vermont and myself and Nico Dorn were there confused. Why are we here? You know, like, there must have been a mistake on the invitation list, because here we are, two young guys that, you know, just like everybody else, feel, you know, incredibly unique. And you and Bobby Ferguson and a few others took time out of it to put your arms around us young guys and just say that we matter, you know? If you want to make an alcoholic cry, just tell them how important they are, right? And you did that for us. And I just want to thank you from the middle of my heart for your service and leadership to our field.
Well, that's, I mean, incredibly kind, and you're right, you... it's flattering. And I'm, you know, I'm grateful. I'm, you know, it's one of the things, again, I'm just coming from on-site. And so one of the things that they were talking about was a little bit about your legacy, you know. And I hope that, I hope my legacy wasn't what I've done, but more along the lines about how I did it. Yeah. And, you know, and I do remember the part with Ruth Ann, and that was, you know, and here's this woman, right, who's just done a ton of service.
A ton.
And I mean, and there's the service that we see, but the greater, it's like the iceberg, right? The greater portion of this service for this woman is stuff that almost nobody in the public ever gets to see, right? And, you know, and I think, you know, one of the reasons it was so emotional that night was just really how overdue her, you know, this accolade was for a person like Ruth Ann. And, you know, and I remember being that young guy in the field, right? And you're the young guy in the field, and you show up, and everybody's sitting at the table, and you don't really have a seat. Right, it's kind of like, and just one more time, I'm the odd man out, right? And how important it was to me when somebody said, "Hey, Gary, do you want to come? Do you want to sit with us?" Right? And I mean, because that's who we grow up being. You know, we just want to be a part of, right? And so for somebody to, and I never forgot that, right? That how, you know, somebody remembering my name, you know, coming up and saying, hey, Gary, do you remember me? And of course I remember them, right? But, and it was just, you know, I just remember, I think, you know, one of the best parts about the field of behavioral health and, you know, residential care is just that, you know, we all tended to look out for each other, right? And it was almost, and again, you know, maybe one of the beauties of the 12-step community, right? Come all the way in, sit all the way down, right? You're part of us, right? And you might not feel part of us right now, but you're part of us. And, you know, and I think one of the things that we, you know, I tried to do was transcend that to, you know, the field. And hey, look, kindness goes a long way, right? And boy, I was a guy who had not been, you know, I mean, I couldn't afford myself kindness. So when you afforded me kindness, I think I was more appreciative.
Yeah. Well, I think if the measure is making sure that everybody feels like they have a seat at the table, you have checked those boxes, Gary, in spades. So, and I hope to be frank, and you know, who knows how people will perceive this conversation, but you know, I hope that we carry your legacy. You know, we carry the legacy of making sure that those folks that are new here, maybe it's a new employee, a new team member, or a new patient, or whoever we cross paths with, a new partner in the community, that there's more than enough room at the table. You know, there's more than enough, something I think about often just being in Tennessee and this idea of competitors and all, and it's like, what are you talking about? You know, there's more than enough really hurting people, you know, that might not get a chance to discover something about this way of life. And it's our responsibility, I think, as temporary proprietors to make sure that they feel welcome. And you segued brilliantly. I was going to ask you what you have loved the most about this work over your career, and I'd be curious how you would answer that question.
Oh, well, it's actually, it's easy, right? It's the people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the relationships. You know, I think one of the great things about, and I'm so in agreement. You know, I think if there was one thing that I understood early on is he was my colleague. He wasn't my competitor. And, you know, the part that just, you know, I just, again, we talked about being out at onsite, right? And, you know, and here, I mean, you know, I get the opportunity to do this podcast, but there were a dozen guys there that have been showing up to onsite literally, I think, for 18 or 19 years, right? And it's one thing to go the first time and do that work, but then to kind of continue to show up so that we could be better men in our marriages, we could be better employees, we could be better employers, right? That we could be better friends, right? And to do this, you know, to do this work. And, you know, hey, look, I grew up in a loving family, right? But sitting in those rooms with those men, I mean, it's like, man, this is love, right?
Yeah.
The new math. And, you know, you talk about having a seat at the table. And I think kind of an interesting piece is last night was the kind of the final supper that they were having for everybody. And they had this really long, lengthy table. And I happened to be sitting just at one end of it. And everybody was talking about their moment of gratitude, right, in this 2 or 3 day period. And I said, you know, I just told everybody, I said, I just wish you could have this view that I have here of this table, right? And the toast that, or last night, was to longer tables. So not only does everybody have a seat, but we can lengthen this table out so that we can, you know, that more people can participate. And, you know, one of the things for the listeners that I think is, I mean, there are so many talented therapists and this was a men's retreat. I think they do the women's retreat in April. So, you know, but, you know, just to longer tables, right? Let's get everybody at the table.
Absolutely.
We'll do better.
So as we wrap up, I have one final question. And this might be the most important question. because I told you before, you know, there's all sorts of folks that are listening to this show. There are, you know, hopefully our friends, you know, our colleagues, you know, some of our team members. But I hope more than any of those, I love all them. Shout out to y'all. But I hope many, if there's anybody else, it's the folks, it's the families that are lost at sea, grasping for any kind of resource. It might be an individual themselves who is using against their will today, like we talked about earlier. And I wonder what you would say to them, what you would say to the mom or the dad or the brother or to the individual themselves that just can't stop using today.
Well, I think, you know, first, one of the things that, talk about shout outs, right? And I think I, you know, a shout out to really some of the staff members at Cirque Lodge that were so influential in my life. And I remember our clinical director, a woman by the name of Beverly Resch, who's, you know, again, another incredibly talented individual. And she would always, at the start of our family week, she would get up and she'd say, you know, your loved one might not get better, but you can. Mm. And, you know, and I think that, you know, one of the things about it is that we all go into care hoping that this other person is, you know, that they can fix them, right? This is from the family standpoint. But the truth of the matter, and just like going to on-site and you know, having the therapists do their own work, is that, you know, for the families to come in and do their own work and again, whether our loved ones get better or whether they don't, that we get better. And in getting better, we change that dynamic, right? We make it a more amenable situation for maybe the addict alcoholic to come back to. And for the addict alcoholic out there who's still suffering, you know, the thing that, you know, the good news, right? The good news is that people get better every day. Mm. And there was a part where, and I remember this, I remember walking into a treatment program, Nick, and I said to the gentleman, I said, we're going to talk about this, and I'm never going to drink or use again. I said, that I just don't think you understand my problem. And I'll never forget, very calmly, he looked at me and he said, well, he said, that doesn't describe the dynamic, but pretty much. And what I will tell you is, for a gentleman, I oftentimes used to say that they should have put my face on a poster that said, basically, if this guy can do it, you can too. And I think that's the thing, is that we don't hear the good news, right? We always hear the bad news, because that's what sells, right? I mean, that's what gets on the 5 o'clock news or the 10 o'clock news, is the overdoses and the, you know, just the robberies and the things that, you know, because that's some sort of titillating piece that draws people in. But, you know, but hey, the news, and I got to see it through, like I said, 23 yeah. years at Cirque and 37 years of being in the behavioral health field.
Yeah.
You know, I got to see people get better every day. I got to see families restored, right? Yeah. I got to see miracles. I got to see miracles here at Cumberland Heights, right? I just coming out and so don't miss the miracle, yeah. right? I had a really good friend of mine in treatment, and I said to him at one point, I said, he had certainly, you know, had a legacy and was this guy. I was like, what are you still doing, right? I mean, it's like, and he looked at me and he said, he says, I'm addicted to the miracle. Mm. Never forget.
100%. Thank you, Gary, so much for being here. We'll let you catch your flight. We love you. We're going to, we hope to see you again out here soon. And we hope you give Brittany a little bit of a hard time for not being here yet. We love her and we need to get her out here. So thanks again, man.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. And thanks to Cumberland.